Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Robert Aberle. Bob is a professor of philosophy at Diablo Valley College. He's been on the program many times before. I hope we'll get him back many times in the future. Today, dare I say, is, well, I think everybody knows what today is, Super Bowl Sunday. Well, it doesn't faze me in the least. I have to think about who's even playing. I'm honestly not very much of a fan, but I know people enjoy it, so I don't want to take the pleasure away from them. But Bob wrote an important article, and I told Bob that I read lots of articles. There are some I wish I wrote, and the article he wrote about Super Bowl Sunday is one that I do wish I wrote, and he titled it War Propaganda, as with Iraq, U.S. Oh, I got the wrong one. I've got another one.
That's pretty close.
I've got another article on my desktop I was looking at for an unrelated reason, Bob. He titled it, It's Super Bowl Sunday, Roman Ritual, American Style, etc., and so on and so forth. Oh, it's a marvelous article, Bob. Discuss it. Let readers know about it, because they absolutely should read it.
Thank you, Stephen. I actually have been thinking about it for a while now, but because it was Super Bowl Sunday, I thought it would be a good idea to share some thoughts about it. It's on globalresearch.ca, where you and I both publish a lot of our material. It's a wonderful website to keep informed about what's going on. But there are certain things that, when you look at any football game, get really put under a magnifying glass during the Super Bowl. And I think I've got five different things, maybe. I don't recall. But the first thing was nationalism, that you see nationalism, the war-whooping national anthem, I called it in the article, and you see a 100-yard American flag stretched over the field. The whole idea of doing that is not just to proclaim that we're the best, you know, USA, USA, but it's actually to kind of stir up this false patriotism that comes about by connecting it with a sporting event that is everybody's really whipped up about anyway. And that directly connects to the militarism that you see with the jets flying overhead during the national anthem, the military jets, and the heavy military presence that you'll see during the game all around in the playing field, where camera shots are framed so that you see the uniformed people in the background. It just doesn't happen that way. That's what is being celebrated at the same time that a football game is going on. And then there's the capitalistic angle as well, where the celebration of football games has this mandatory look at the individualist owners of these teams so that they can sing the praises of this great individual capitalist who has managed to buy himself a football team. Aside from the Green Bay Packers, which I mentioned in the article, every team in the NFL is owned by a billionaire. And so they're celebrating a billionaire's being a billionaire. So there's that capitalist angle in there, and there's no community representation. So the teams that are playing, Denver and Seattle, don't really represent their cities. They represent the billionaire's purchasing power. And they will make reference to all of that. The announcers will. They'll have a camera shot of the owners, but they won't be telling you, this is what we're really celebrating. Look at this wonderful billionaire. And then when you look at the teams themselves, one of the questions that I ask is, how many of the people on those teams would you want your kids to be like? And then I thought about the main names, Richard Sherman, who, and Pete Carroll, his coach for Seattle, very, very disrespectful and arrogant regarding their own abilities and the teams that they play. I don't know that those are good role models. So people look at Peyton Manning. He's a nice guy. He's a clean-cut American frat guy. But he's also a billionaire himself. He's made many, many millions simply by appearing on every commercial break with Papa John from Papa John's Pizza. Papa John is one of the very first people who, when the Affordable Health Care Act came out, said, I don't want to pay it. So he cut all of his full-time employees down to 30 hours so he didn't have to pay it, any health insurance. He was one of the first to do that. It increases his profit, and it is part of the war on the working class that's been going on. So they're doing very well. Peyton Manning's making millions. Papa John's making billions. Manning's making billions, too. And so they're all happy and smiles, and we're supposed to buy into that. So I don't see a lot of character there that I would want my kids to emulate. So maybe I'll stop there and see if you want to jump in.
I live in downtown Chicago, as you know, Bob. A lot of listeners and my readers, I think, know that as well. And if you live in a big city like I do, you're liable to run into anybody on the street every now and then. And over the years, I've run into a number of well-known sports figures. I remember Steve Garvey, the former Los Angeles Dodger. I once bumped into Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics. Who was the famous announcer who was close to Muhammad Ali?
Howard Cosell.
Howard Cosell. I once passed him on the street.
Oh, wow. Did they have big entourages?
No, I can't remember anybody who had a lot of people around them. Steve Garvey was walking all by himself. It was early in the morning, and he was going one way, I was going another. We passed each other on the street. I didn't say anything to him. A few years ago, early on a Sunday morning, I ran an errand at my local Walgreens drugstore a couple of blocks down the street from me, and I bumped into the Steeler quarterback, Roethlisberger. I never would have known who he was, except he had on a jersey with the name Roethlisberger on the back of it, and he was a big guy, and there was another fellow with him with the same color jersey, and I forget his name, and we headed for the same aisle. I didn't follow him. We just happened to end up in the same aisle. And I said, are you... And at first he said, no.
Yeah.
I said, are you really... The more I thought about it, I didn't know who he was. But he kind of looked like the kind of guy who would be a quarterback, a big guy. He was kind of cool. And the other fellow with him, I can't remember his name. He was a much smaller guy, maybe a defensive back or something or other. He was very pleasant. Because I lived in Pittsburgh for 5 years back in the 1960s before either of these guys were born. And I mentioned where I lived, and it lit the other guy up. Maybe he lived there himself or close to it. So we started talking about Pittsburgh, and that I enjoyed, and he enjoyed. Well, I enjoyed chatting for a few minutes with the other guy, and I really didn't get much out of Roethlisberger. Maybe he's too busy counting his money.
Could be. He was another person that I could have put in my article when I talked about the ethics of the NFL. Not only are they trying to deal with this massive scandal about the cover-up of their knowledge that the players were suffering brain damage from repeated concussions, but when you look at the legal record and the rap sheet of some of these NFL players, they have almost all received very substantially reduced sentences for their crimes that they've committed, and that includes Roethlisberger. He was about to be on trial for sexual assault.
And
he managed to escape. And John Brent of the Dallas Cowboys, as I mentioned in the article, he's the latest one that I am aware of, got only 180 days of jail time for intoxicated manslaughter. But if you or I had done that, we'd been in for years. So there's a lot of issues that we need to take a look at as we're watching the game, if we're watching the game today.
Oh, absolutely. Privilege has its privilege, Bob. And it really is disgusting. I put out an article on New York possibly ending its stop-and-frisk program. I got it out yesterday. But I wanted to I wrote several other articles about that. And the new mayor, Bill de Blasio, said he wants to end the practice. Well, I titled my article, New York Ending Stop-and-Frisk with a question mark, because I'm not certain it's going to end at all. Maybe there'll be some mitigation in some ways. But racism is so institutionalized in America. I wanted to talk about more than stop and frisk. So I put a great deal in my article about institutionalized racism and the effect it has on people, Latinos and black people. And conditions today are literally worse than back when Martin Luther King was really waging a courageous struggle to end civil rights abuses. And I remember several years ago quoting a civil rights leader, and I can't recall his name. I think he might have been someone with MLK's a Southern Christian Leadership Association. But several years ago, it might have been 5 years ago now, he said to the effect that conditions today are worse than they were in the early 1960s and 1950s, and I believe it. So maybe segregation is officially outlawed. We've got the Civil Rights Act. We've got the Voting Rights Act. But in practice, the same old Jim Crow exists. So is New York going to stop and frisk? I kind of doubt it.
They say so, and de Blasio is saying all the right words. I mean, I watched his speech, and I thought it was really great. But, again, it's like you're saying, it's like it's a speech, and the question is, what's the reality going to be in comparison with that speech? And it's the same that you find with President Obama's State of the Union address that I know you've written an article about, which was quite good. Taking a look, I really liked what you did in the article. You took a look at Obama's first State of the Union, the promises that he made, and then the realities that occurred, and then you looked at the most recent one. And in my view, you didn't really say this in your article too much, although it was implied, this latest State of the Union address was much more filled with lies and empty promises than I remember hearing in the first State of the Union address. And you do highlight those in your article quite nicely. He lied about keeping our union strong. He lied about the lowest unemployment rate. He lied that the United States is in the best position in the 21st century, ignoring China's growth rate and all that stuff. So it's the same type of thing that we see in New York, politicians doing a lot of glossy speech, but we don't see a lot of reality that comes behind it. So I'm bridging over to Obama's State of the Union from your great article, but it certainly works that way.
Oh, it really is, Bob. I've written so many articles about Obama beginning when he was campaigning in 2007 and 2008, and over time he really made it so easy for me to beat up on him because I can go back and I can look in some cases and get direct quotes on things he said and then show the policies that were instituted when he was elected president. I put out a new article this morning that I titled, Obama Planning War on Syria with a question mark, and we recall last August, there was a false flag chemical weapons attack that President Assad of Syria was falsely blamed for. It was definitely, I mean, evidence was overwhelming that the so-called rebels, the insurgents, Western-supported death squads were responsible for this attack. And we don't know how many people were killed. The reports vary greatly. No two reports could agree with each other, but probably there could have been a couple of 300 people killed. I think John Kerry claimed 1,400, something like that. It wasn't 1,400. It could have been a couple of hundred or so. The point is, it was a terrible crime, and the Syrian government had nothing to do with it, or any other chemical weapons attack. And the more John Kerry and Obama and other U.S. officials talked about this incident, the more they hung themselves out to dry, the more they exposed themselves as liars, because more evidence kept coming out. Russia did a study on it. Russia proved it. There was even a UN study that showed that the Assad government had nothing whatsoever to do with this. They couldn't prove any chemical attack on the Assad government, but this was the implication. And Obama was right on the brink of going to war with Syria late August or early September. I mean, literally, the bombs were about to fall. And overwhelming anti-war opposition in America, bombarding Congress, House Representatives, Senators, with anti-war messages. Republicans were getting anti-war messages 100, 200 to 1. They never saw anything like that before. And they literally said they couldn't support a war, so Obama was forced to back off. But I don't think he ended the war. I think he suspended it, and I very much fear that's what's coming. So it's so easy to manufacture pretext, Bob, as we know. You know, Syria is getting rid of its chemical weapons. It's only gotten rid of about 5% of them so far. But there are serious issues that aren't reported when Kerry beats up on Assad. The big issue is you've got these terrorists all over the place. In transporting these weapons, you've got to be darn sure, most of all, none of them fall into these people's hands. That would be a disaster. But you never hear Kerry saying anything about that.
No, you don't. What you hear instead is Kerry making his unbelievable threats against Syria when he made the opening speech in what he calls the Geneva II conference that started last week. He says Bashar Assad will not be part of the transitional government. There is no way possible that a man who has led a brutal assault on his own people can gain legitimacy, something like that. And then he turns right around, which goes back to your point, and demonstrates that the Obama administration has not learned from their initial attempts to use false flag operations against Assad. Because then they turned right around, and at the end of January, they came out with new unsubstantiated charges of torture and murder against the Syrian people committed by Bashar al-Assad. And it comes from this committee that I think is based in London that was financed by Qatar, which funds the Al-Qaeda opposition along with the United States. And they say, well, this all goes back. All the evidence we have was from this codenamed guy, Caesar, who was working with the opposition groups. And Caesar comes across with this evidence that 11,000 people were killed. Nobody can substantiate that. The report simply says, well, we've seen the photos. But they also mention that the photos had their time and date and location stamps blurred. So nobody knows where they were taken, when they were taken, or who was responsible for that. But Kerry tried to trump that out, and that fell flat. I mean, most people haven't even heard of that because everybody just dropped that right away. Because if you remember Curveball, what the Bush administration did with Iraq, this is the exact same thing that was tried with Iraq and succeeded. People are now aware of that.
So oh, indeed, but I wrote about the report. Yeah, Qatar financed this report. A London law firm was involved. Two former UN prosecutors were involved from the Yugoslav tribunal and.
Right.
I forget the other one. It was a setup. It was an absolute setup. And the London Guardian that occasionally publishes some good articles, it disgraced themselves by putting out a report on this like it was gospel, like it was true. It was absolute rubbish. I mean, photos are so easy to fabricate, Bob. I remember during the Libyan war, there was a phony celebration videotaped of the rebel forces coming into Tripoli, close to when the city fell. It showed mass jubilation of Libyans celebrating the entrance into their city of these hired guns, these killers. Well, it turned out that this was a film made many weeks in advance. It was made in Qatar. It was made on a Hollywood soundstage, complete with hundreds of extras and so on. It was all fake. It was all fake. It had nothing to do with what was going on in Tripoli, but this aired on BBC. I think CNN aired it. Al Jazeera, of course. I mean, just plain propaganda, same kind of stuff as this. You know, sometimes it works, Bob, and sometimes it doesn't. Well, so far it hasn't worked against Syria, and I certainly hope it won't.
Well, I hope it doesn't, but you mentioned Libya, and we can go back and take another look at Libya, too, because there's an insurrection that has been brewing as a result of the United States invasion. So Libya is just kind of ahead of the curve because they were attacked by the United States before Syria. But we can see what's going on now in the south of Libya. There's alliances that are occurring between various pro-Gaddafi forces that are now fighting back with military weaponry against the NATO-installed government of Libya. And there's reports that have been coming out of southern Libya saying that there's the green flag of the Great Socialist People's Libyan, I don't remember what it's called, but the green flag, which is not the same as the Libyan flag today, flying over a number of cities in the southern part of Libya, and the Prime Minister of Libya, Ali Zaidan, calling it a state of emergency because of all of the violence going on. Government officials are being attacked in Libya. There's an insurrection going on there, and it has not stopped simply because the United States has changed its focus over to Syria. And this is what we're doing in Syria, too. Actually, we're doing it in Iraq. Iraq continues that process, too, of descent into a civil war. So we're lighting all these fires everywhere. And in Syria, it's just the first start of it because we're having our proxies do it for us right now. I don't think that Obama's done with Syria yet. I think he's backed off for now for a number of different reasons, but one of the reasons is that he's trying to pivot to Asia, and that's going to get in the way of the pivot to Asia that he's trying to do. But we're seeing that all of these various conflagrations that are going on have not stopped simply because the United States has gotten rid of the leader that they wanted to get rid of so that they could get in and get the resources that they wanted. But if you look at this, and I was looking at this right before we went on air. You look at what's going on around the world that the United States has got its finger on, and Germany now, too, has its finger on. There is a perfect storm brewing for World War III, and I don't want to sound inflammatory or like I'm stating it too strongly, but I think that there is evidence for this. There's at least 10 different stories that would indicate that we're right in this kind of gray area about, are we going to go into war as a world, or are we going to back off from this? When you look at the German militarism, which I do want to talk about today before we get off the air, that Angela Merkel talked about yesterday in her State of the German Nation or whatever yesterday, you talk about what's going on in Ukraine right now, what's going on in Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Libya. You talk about the possible coming war between Japan and China, which we can talk about with Prime Minister Abe talking about, this is just like World War II, China's just like the German-England relationship before World War II and all that. The United States is about to start war games with South Korea in that whole area. Obama's drone campaign has increased in the world, and it's celebrating the fifth anniversary of that now. There's a global plutocracy that wants the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, passed. There's global unemployment that has reached record proportions. I think I got 10 in there, but if not, there's more I could talk about. But those are all really very shaky situations that we have all around the world. We've seen this before. We've seen this before World War II in particular. So you've got a very depressed populace getting continually put upon, and a global plutocracy that will stop at nothing. And you've got all of these fires that the United States, instead of Germany this time, has lit. Well, we've got a situation that could get out of our hands and get out of control very quickly.
Oh, I absolutely agree, Bob, and I've mentioned the threat of global war so many times in articles that I've written. It's a real threat. I don't know that it's anything that any nation wants, but did any nation want World War One? I mean, there was a great rivalry then between Britain and Germany. I know that that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to get into the war against Hitler in Europe. At the same time, Hitler could have been stopped before that war ever began. Hitler was installed. Western bankers, British bankers, had a great deal to do with installing Hitler. He was never elected. He was appointed. He wasn't elected chancellor. He became appointed. And the aging president of Germany, von Hindenburg, I think he reached the point of senility, not really able to stop the momentum that was building and the forces from outside. But it didn't take Hitler long to consolidate his power and then started running roughshod over Europe, not starting a war until September 1939. But he could have been stopped long before that. Not a finger was lifted to do it. And Roosevelt wanted to get into a war. He wanted a war with Japan. Well, he certainly got a war with Japan, and he wanted to get into the war with Europe as Hitler's militarism began ramping up. And it's very easy to find a way to do it when you want to do it. So there you have it, World War II. And if you can have two world wars, is it unthinkable to imagine you can't have a third? Absolutely not. You could have a third. And the scary part, Bob, is the weapons that exist today were non-existent for the first two. If we ever get into a global war, I mean, the possibility could be curtains for the planet.
Could be. That's the thing that bothers me and scares me. And I think that you've got these various flames that are starting to consume fuel in various places. And Ukraine is one of those flashpoints right now. The Democracy Now! Had an interview with a political professor whose name is Richard Cohen. He really focuses on Russian studies at Princeton University, I believe. And he said this whole thing that's going on in Ukraine and Germany's role in it and the United States' role in it is the most important international story going on right now. Because it, in his view, it could be the flashpoint for a new European war. And then, and I thought that was really stunning to hear someone who is very studied in this and really knows his stuff to actually make that case. He does it in part in, he's got a book called Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, but that's more of a historical thing. But now he's saying this is the flashpoint. So I listened to that interview and I took it into account and I paid attention to what he was saying and I thought, well, he makes a pretty good case for that. But just yesterday, Angela Merkel comes out and speaks to the German government saying that from this point forward, not only do we support the right-wing protesters in Ukraine, but what we're going to do is lift the end of our policy that we've had since World War II of military restraint. So now Merkel says we're going to use our military wherever we think we need to use it. That's pretty much what her message was. She says, her exact words, I wrote them down, was, we will use our military with all means available to us. So she's basically saying, we're ready to go, you know, whenever we're needed anywhere that we think. And she immediately expressed her support for the demonstrations in Ukraine. So she's tying the German military to the Ukrainian position right now. Military restraint is no longer part of the German military doctrine right now. She said Germany was too big and too important not to be involved. So immediately her defense minister starts talking about, well, we're talking about a German military plan for Africa, South Africa, and for Mali. And so this is a pretty seismic shift in German policy. We have not heard this kind of stuff since the Nazi dictatorship that occurred from Germany. So now you've got Merkel saying, we're going to support Vitaly Klitschko in the Ukraine, and he is directly sponsored by the Christian Democratic Union, which is Merkel's party. And now she's saying, we're not going to hesitate to use our military to protect our interests. Well, you've got the United States saying the exact same thing, and they're with the European Union in fomenting this situation in the Ukraine. So there's another flashpoint.
Oh, I agree. That's very scary stuff. I don't know about her speech. I've got to look that up, Bob. That is very, very scary, because we haven't heard that stuff come out of Germany, my goodness, in decades. I do know that, of course, Germany is a NATO partner, one of the 28 NATO countries, so it's very much involved in NATO wars. It was very much involved in supporting Washington's war on Libya, Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. Whether it sent troops or not didn't matter. It provided support. It certainly provided moral support before Merkel was even chancellor. So the idea that Merkel will overtly come out and say German military forces will be involved in conflicts, that's very scary stuff. I mean, Germany could be... Germany is an economic juggernaut. It could ramp up its military more and be a military juggernaut. It could be the most powerful military in Europe. If it wanted to, it could easily develop nuclear weapons. Who knows if they don't have a program going now. But Merkel, I only wrote one article about Merkel. She's certainly very, very conservative. She's Machiavellian. She has gone after her opponents in working her way up politically, rather ruthlessly. So I wouldn't put anything past her. You know, smiling face, looks like a pleasant woman. Well, don't let that deceive you. She doesn't really come in your face the way Margaret Thatcher did. But there's a lot of evil behind that face. So I'm very, very worried about what you say.
Yeah, and the fact that she's directly supporting Vitaly Klitschko, who has himself been involved in rejecting the concession that was made from Yanukovych, President Yanukovych in Ukraine. He actually agreed that there should be new leaders of the opposition put in the parliament, and they just flat out rejected it. And Klitschko actually said protesters might start trying to kill the top government officials now. And that's all got the backing of the German government. So you have kind of neo-fascist paramilitary groups that are in that right-wing building taking. I think they've occupied like 9 buildings of the government now in various cities. And you've got Klitschko saying, well, we might start knocking off some of the government officials of Yanukovych's government. And Merkel saying, we support that, that's a really dangerous situation. And then, of course, you get that idiot, John McCain, who he never picks a side that he should be on, who goes to Ukraine and says, we support all of the protesters here. We support what's going on here. And gets all the cheers from doing that. And he's on the wrong side again. He's on the side of the neo-fascists. So this could come to a head really fast. And I think that's why Stephen Cohen was saying, this is the number one story. And it wasn't but a couple of days after he talked about that Merkel came out with her speech. And now it really is a big story that we have to keep an eye on.
Oh, it really is. I just, while you were talking, Bob, I did a very fast Google search. There's an article on Der Spiegel. Let's see if I can find a date. 28th of January. And the title is Foreign Policy Rethink, Germany Weighs Stronger Military Role. Der Spiegel, Germany Weighs Stronger Military Role. I'll read it when we get off air, Bob, but this scares me, and I'm probably going to have to write something about this. I may either do it separately or include it in another article. I agree. Ukraine is a terrible flashpoint. I've had a couple of interviews on it. I had a short interview on a Press TV newscast today. They covered a lot of stories, and they gave me just some brief comments on Ukraine. It really demands much more intensive discussion, because what's going on, literally, it's a battle of democratic governance in Ukraine versus Washington want neo-fascists, pro-Western neo-fascists replacing the city government. Sitting government is far from perfect. It's a government that was installed, that won a democratic election, and was the sitting government in 2004 when the Orange Revolution, instigated by Washington George Bush, unseated him, Viktor Yanukovych. And now we see Orange Revolution 2.0, but the first one wasn't violent like this. Mass protests orchestrated by the West, but these are vicious. Extremely violent.
Russia too.
Oh yeah.
In that regard.
Oh, this very much targets Russia. I hear the music, so
yeah.
We need to take a break. Let's come back and talk about this a little bit more, Bob.
Okay.
We'll take a break and be right back. Welcome back. Talking with Bob Amelie. Bob, let's get back to Ukraine a little bit. Most people, most listeners probably have heard of Ukraine. I would say a good many probably know something about it and no doubt a little bit about what's going on. But Ukraine is a very strategically important country. It's by far the most important of the former Soviet republics. It's a large country. It's a rich agricultural country. It has other valued resources, but its geopolitical importance is what's most valued. So in a way, the West sees a tug of war between itself, Washington, key EU countries, and Russia for which side, east or west, will have most influence. Well, the rhetoric coming out of Ukraine, the government, is very sensible. It's the way I would talk. Ukraine would like to have good relations with all countries. It doesn't want to be a Western one or an Eastern one. It wants to be a world government, a world country. It wants good relations with everybody, but that's not what Washington wants. Washington wants Russia shut out. It wants to control Ukraine. It wants to exploit its people. It wants Western corporations getting the benefits of whatever can be gotten out of Ukraine profit-wise. It wants to encroach on Russia's borders. It's really revving for an eventual fight, as you mentioned, Bob, and it's doing it with other former Soviet republics, where Washington is installing so-called missile defense that has nothing to do with defense and has everything to do with offense on Russia's borders. Well, Russia has every reason to be furious about this. It could jeopardize relations, and one thing can lead to another. As you know, Bob, we can see ourselves into something going on beyond a war of words.
You know, that what you just said is something that Putin said as well when this whole thing got really revved up. Putin said, why don't we have a three-way kind of coalition with Ukraine, that Russia will be involved, the Ukrainians will be involved, and the European Union will be involved.
Yes.
And that was shot down right away by Klitschko and the protesters. And I think the reason they did it is this. I think that it was really a function of what the European Union said to the Ukraine. They said to the Ukrainian government, which I'll add, by the way, parenthetically, is a democratically elected government. So if the EU and the United States is going to overthrow that, they're overthrowing a democracy. For what? For a capitalist fascist government? Who knows? But anyway, that's parenthetical. The Ukrainian government was given an ultimatum by the European Union, and this was the start of all of these protests. The European Union said, there's going to be no three-way agreement here. You have to sign an economic agreement with us, or you can sign one with Russia, but you can't sign one with both countries. So what Ukraine was talking to the European Union about was they needed a lot of money. I mean, they were they're in a lot of financial trouble too. So they needed billions of dollars. And the European Union said, well, we'll give you some millions of dollars, but you got to side with us and cut out Russia from your agreements. And that puts them under NATO's umbrella, and that goes back to the strategic game plan that you're talking about. In the meantime, Russia's got its own complaints with the European Union. I know that Moscow just filed a complaint with the World Trade Organization because of the EU taxes on the products that Russia is exporting to Europe. And then you bring the energy equation in. This has got to be part of this, too. A lot of natural gas comes from Gazprom. It comes from Russia. It goes through into Ukraine and goes into Europe. So there's a lot of tensions about that as well. So you've got a lot of inflammatory points going on here. The European Union, with Obama's blessing, is saying, give us Ukraine or Russia, but you can't have both, and we're going to war against you if you don't make our decision. Russia is saying, let's do a three-way here, and Ukraine split right down the middle. And this is what I take from Stephen Cohen, who says in some of his writings, and certainly said it on Democracy Now!, there's really no one Ukraine anymore. Because of the European Union's ultimatum, there's two Ukraines, and they're split right down the middle. Half the populace wants a Ukraine that sides with Russia. Half the populace wants a Ukraine that sides with the European Union. One, if you go with the European Union, you get complete austerity, just like Greece, Portugal, other places. Russia's trying to avoid that happening. If you get austerity in Ukraine, you got a real problem.
Oh, you sure do, Bob. Ukraine, east and west. The eastern part is predominantly looking east, wanting alignment with Russia and with China. And the western part is predominantly looking west, aligning with the EU countries, aligning with Washington. At the same time, I think most Ukrainians, including in the west, want nothing to do with the street violence. They want nothing. Klitschko is not quite as violent as the most extreme neo-fascist. I think they even make him nervous. He's the former heavyweight boxing champion, right?
Right.
I saw a photo of him. I was standing... Kerry's a pretty big guy. I saw a photo of him standing with Kerry, and he towered over Kerry. My goodness, he must be a monster of a guy physically.
That matches up, because Kerry's become a monster politically, so
indeed.
They kind of fear each other.
Oh, indeed so. But he absolutely is militantly. You see the things that they're saying, Bob. You watch their lips move, but the words are coming out of Washington and Brussels. This is where the policy is coming from, and these people are mouthing their words. The National Endowment for Democracy is actively involved supporting these people, funding them. The State Department funds the National Endowment for Democracy. I think there are other organizations like it, maybe USAID, CIA related, they're involved. So this is all Western mischief that's going on in Ukraine. I mean, the Battle of Ukraine, that could end up being more than street battles in the country, mostly in Kiev, but in some other Western cities as well, and it could end up being something much, much more serious than that, where it literally could explode cross-border, and that's the last thing that Russia wants. Does Obama want it? I don't know what the devil Obama wants. I mean, he's rushing headlong into one conflict after another. I know he's a front guy. I know he basically represents the system. So in my mind, I say, what does the system want? Well, Obama is their guy. He's still, as Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. And there were presidents like Kennedy who put his foot down and decided he would only go so far and no further. And then he wanted to reverse course. Of course, we know what happened to Kennedy, and that lesson has not been lost on future presidents. But if you don't want to get into that maelstrom, then why take the job in the first place? I would never, never be a pro-war president. Of course, I never would be elected. I never could go out on the stump. Well, you can say anything you want on the stump, and I've gone through Obama's campaign speeches. I've quoted him verbatim on them, including his first State of the Union address that I quoted and other speeches that he gave in 2009. I forget the month, I think it was a few months into the year, his first year, he visited Cairo and made glorious comments about wanting peace in the Middle East and being friends to the Muslim people, everything you want to hear, everything you wish could come true, Bob, and his policies have been polar opposite literally from day one, so you can't believe a word out of his mouth. He represents the system, and the system is an evil system.
Well, I mean, you're exactly right with that, especially that last line. And the latest episode of that is the rallies that Obama has been holding in various cities since his State of the Union address, where he talks about how great it is that Costco, for example, is going to pay their employees the minimum wage that he is going to stipulate that federal contractors be paid of $10.10, you know, the $10.10 an hour. But he's talked in all of his rallies about the CEOs are my friends, the CEOs are my allies, and we're going to help you out. So what does he do? He has this very highly publicized meeting. I think it was on Friday. I may be wrong. It was sometime this past week. Between himself and several hundred corporate CEOs at the White House, and they came out with a plan that they were going to use to help the American people with their job situation, the unemployment situation, the underemployment situation. And I jotted down a couple things that I read from the news that they came out with. I'm not going to go through all the details of this, but they have a very long list of plans that they had. But one of the plans calls for $1.25, excuse me, $1.25 in corporate spending for each long-term unemployed worker. Stephen, I'm going to set the phone down for a second.
Okay. I wrote about Obama's $10.10 an hour.
Okay, just wanted to get a drink of water.
Oh, do it, Bob. While you're doing that, I'll explain Obama's $10.10 an hour. It's a fraud. It's an absolute fraud. 40-hour week, 52 weeks a year, it comes to $21,000. The official poverty, according to the Census Bureau, for a family of four is $23,500, but it's based on over a four-decade-old guideline. So that $23,500 minimally should be at least double that today to stay out of poverty for a family of four. $21,000, an individual in Chicago making $21,000 would have a very, very hard time getting enough food to eat, getting the most minimal kind of shelter, absolutely no amenities. It's a fraud. People need at least double that amount, at least double that amount to have a decent wage, but they won't, and Obama's plan is fake. And, of course, he offered it by executive order only to U.S. federal contract workers, not all federal workers, not state workers, public workers, not local city public workers, not private sector workers. He offered it to a sliver of U.S. workers, and he offered them peanuts where they really need real help. He fell way, way short.
Yeah, and that was the point that I was starting to make before I got something caught in my throat here. But the plan that these corporate leaders with Obama came out with is exactly what you just said. It's a sliver. They couldn't possibly have done less. And here's a couple of the things they said. We're going to spend $1.25 for each long-term unemployed worker. It's called the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. That's what they announced. In Chicago, your hometown, well, not your hometown, but where you live, in conjunction with Rahm Emanuel, the great mayor of Chicago, they're going to do job placement services for 120 workers in 2014, for the whole year, 120 more workers.
120 workers, wow.
There's a job training program in Washington, D.C. that this corporate group is setting up that's going to serve 80 workers this year. PG&E in California is going to provide 48 people with resume building and interview skills. This is the stuff that Obama came up with these corporate executives. Now, all you have to do is compare that to the profit that the corporations are taking in, and who was represented there? The top 80 corporations in the nation's business sector. J.P. Morgan Chase was present in the White House, Walmart, PG&E, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, even McDonald's was there. And Obama's federal contribution is zero. Because what Obama decided to do through his administration is to shift the books a bit. So they're going to take funding that is in one category right now and move it to a different category, and they're going to call that their contribution. But they're not spending any more money on this. In the meantime, they come out with that, and Obama's still touring around talking about how great it is that businesses are going to start helping out and getting the unemployment problem solved, and they're going to create more new jobs. He's not saying anything about the really low wages of those jobs. He's not saying anything about the tens of millions of jobs that were lost between 2007 and 2009. But this is all this blue smoke and mirrors that is going on, and there's nothing happening at all.
There's nothing at all, Bob. There are over 100 million working-age adults, working-age Americans, let's put it that way, maybe age 18 or over, who would like to be working. Most of them would like to be working, but they're not. because they can't find jobs. And from when Obama took office to virtually today, there are 10 million more Americans who would like to work but can't find jobs. And that's Obama's job creation program. And everything you just said that I wasn't aware of, Bob, I mean, that really puts an exclamation point on an absolutely fraudulent program that'll do zero for people desperate to find a job. And when companies announce it, they usually do it a little quietly, I think, because they can get 1,000 applicants for every crummy job that they want to fill. And if they announce it publicly, you'll see people lined up in front of their office wanting to get a crummy job, and just a handful will get the jobs, and most of the others will go home without them. Real unemployment in America is 23.3%. And it's going to go over 25, maybe it'll go over 30 before the crisis really hits full force. And we haven't seen anything yet. I mean, we're going to see it. We saw it in 2008 or 2009. We're going to see it again. I don't know when. It could be this year, could be next year, could be the year after. Bob, I had a wonderful guest on this program until very sadly he took ill a couple of years ago and he passed away, Bob Chapman. I used to get him on regularly. He was a former insider, had his own investment operation. Earlier, he worked on Wall Street. He was really a good guy. He was really piped in with a lot of insider information from sources that he knew. And he writes a newsletter called The International Forecaster that's still being put out by others in his absence. But he was such a valued guest, Bob, because he sent me the forecast. I still get the forecaster. He sent it to me twice a week, just filled with valuable information. And I remember writing and is talking about predicting that sometime between 2012 and 2017, the whole house of cards would collapse. He didn't know when. He couldn't predict what the trigger would be. But he said, I mean, this, and the longer this thing festers unresolved, and it is festering year after year, the worse the problem gets, the bigger the balloon gets, or the bubble, call it anything you want. And when this thing goes, it's going to be a pop. It's going to be a bang that really is extraordinary. And there are some people a lot smarter than I am who think when it finally happens, it's going to be a lot worse than what we saw in 2008, and that was absolutely horrific.
That's what the people that I have read, the economists that I have read, have been saying as well. That's what scares me about what is coming. And I've read Tom Hartman's book, The Crash of 2016, and he makes a fairly good case that that would be a year to watch for where that comes down. I know that there's going to have to be a reset here because we're headed headlong into a brick wall. Economically speaking, and that includes the real estate market and everything else that is involved with all of this. So I think that there's real problems. And I want to contrast what you're saying, Stephen, to a news story that came out, 2 weeks ago, maybe three now. I don't recall the timing, but it was beginning mid-January. For the first time in U.S. history, more than half of the members of Congress are millionaires. And this article named names, and I didn't write any of the names down, but, I mean, if over half of our congressmen are millionaires, you know what they're doing in terms of their budgetary and unemployment prospects. Nothing. Because they're the stockholders of the major corporations. And their holdings are in three areas, as I understand it. Stock market, real estate, oil. Oh, there's a fourth one. Banks. They're in there. Mm. So if the people who run our government, which is allegedly for the people, are millionaires, and they're watching out for their millionaire buddies, which seems pretty clear, there's only one way that you can describe that form of government, oligarchy. And it's not a democracy. And so we can't be talking about it being a democracy, and we can't look to Capitol Hill because they're not going to do anything short of an American revolution, because they're in the process now of stripping away more and more regulations on business while they're dismantling social programs like SNAP. I mean, SNAP has been all over the news. They've gotten slash after slash, literally two big slashes in a row.
Yes.
While corporations are being deregulated even further, and their tax rate is falling. And I meant to mention this when we were talking about Obama's State of the Union address. One of the first things I remember Obama saying in that address is he called for a lowering of corporate tax rates. So you got corporate tax rates dropping. Of course, we can't have a good democracy if the corporations aren't paying anything at all. But and at the same time, social programs are getting gutted, and our Congress people are millionaires. Now, where does that lead the people? It leaves them exactly where it is for the Super Bowl today. All the millionaires get to go to the Super Bowl and to the elite penthouses all around and the hotels around the Super Bowl. The people aren't invited. And the people aren't invited to this party either that Obama's throwing for his millionaire buddies.
Bob, absolutely right. I wrote about the millionaires in Congress, mostly in the Senate, but I think the richest ones are in the House now. But John Kerry, when he was a U.S. Senator, was the richest member of Congress by far. He is a multi-billionaire. He's got a lot of wealth on his own. He's got wealth through his wife, Teresa Hines, heir to the H.J. Hines fortune. Nobody knows exactly how much, but an estimate I used that I saw was $3.5 billion. What side do you think he's on? He's certainly not on the side of ordinary people. That's the guy, head of the U.S. State Department. I call him Obama's front war in the war on humanity. John Kerry. I don't know what he's, I don't know where he is today. He was in Munich. I think he's still in Munich today. And where he goes next, I have no idea. I wrote an article on his speech versus, Sergey Lavrov, and I'll put that out tomorrow, as well as my Syria article. It's very serious stuff, Bob. We're just about out of time. Gerald Celente, by the way, thinks that maybe by the end of June or sooner, we'll see push come to shove. And he gave an interview, and I've just got snippets of it. I don't have time to really go through it, but he sees the turmoil beginning right now, and he uses a line saying, we're going to see heads roll, and it's beginning to happen. I'm going to have to listen to the interview. I think I've got a link to it. And he makes some very good forecasts at times. He doesn't get them all, but he's been forecasting trouble for a long time, and maybe it'll happen this year. It's certainly going to happen sooner or later, and it's going to be awful. It's going to be something neither you nor I or anybody else wants to see. But ordinary people who really are suffering now, they're the ones that'll be hurt most.
Well, the reason that that's coming is because from the 2008 bailouts that were done, and this is Obama's fault as well as George Bush's fault with all of this, but there have been no changes to the system at all. And so the things that caused the crash originally from the system are still in place today. The mechanisms are still there. The lack of regulation is still there. Not a single thing changed except the incredible bailout from our money to the banks. That's the only thing that changed. The rich got richer with all of that. So until we actually have systemic change in the capitalist system one way or the other, I don't know if I would go as far as the socialist viewpoint that it all has to collapse. Maybe that would be the only way out of this. But until there's systemic change, we're going to see these crises keep coming up over and over again. But I think they're going to keep getting worse now, and I think the distance between them is going to be shorter because we've really seen the end of capitalism as we know it. It can't continue like this. There's got to be something that changes.
It has to change, Bob. We're just about out of time. I'll mention that I was a product of small business through most of my working life. It was absolutely polar opposite to predatory capitalism that ravages the world, that gets governments to fight its wars for them. We never got a dime in corporate welfare. We never got anything. We would have been laughed at if we even requested it. We believe that it was good business to operate responsibly, but that's not the way the big boys work, and it certainly isn't the way they conspire with government to literally rip off the world so they can make an extra buck. Bob, it was a great program. I look forward to getting you back. Super Bowl, I've got more important things to do than watch the Super Bowl.
If you're going to watch it, just watch it with critical reflection about what it is you're taking in. That's what I would say.
Oh, indeed so. I think about that even in big-time college sports where these kids, you know, they get a free scholarship, big deal. A lot of them never even graduate, but they're really exploited so the big-time colleges can make lots of money. And a small sliver of these guys make it into the big time. Most of them just become nobodies once they get out of college. And if they don't have an education, some of them maybe come out illiterate. I don't know. It really is a very sad situation. Again, it's exploitation for a buck. It's to hell with the people that you use. Bob, I look forward to getting you back next month for more.
Thank you, Stephen. I'll look forward to it.
Join us every Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.